This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Downtown Manchester was a hotbed of libertarian celebration this weekend as the New Hampshire Free State Project held its annual convention. The project is more than a decade old, described as an effort to attract 20,000 liberty-minded folks to move to the Granite State. And toward that end, this weekend's event included tours of New Hampshire, sessions on its politics and history, a real estate seminar on finding the perfect place to settle in, and a film called 101 Reasons Why Liberty Lives in New Hampshire. Of course, there were also speakers galore, including our guest today, David Bowes. He's one of the country's leading libertarian thinkers, executive vice president at the Cato Institute in Washington, a frequent writer and commentator in national media, and the author of several books, including his most recent, The Libertarian Mind, A Manifesto for Freedom. He's in the Exchange studios today, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And David Bowes, I've heard your voice so many times on national media, it's nice to finally meet you.
Thank you.
Welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you. It's nice to be in a state where the Libertarian Conference makes the front page of the major newspaper.
Well, there's been a lot written lately, including in your book, David, about how this moment, where we are right now, seems to be a great moment for libertarians, with some of your long-held ideals gaining traction in the political mainstream. You know, distaste for government spying, support for legalizing marijuana. How do you describe this moment, David?
I think one of the things that happens, distrust of government is in America's DNA, I say in the book. And skepticism about power is a very deeply rooted American attitude. Individualism, self-reliance, free enterprise, all of those deep American ideas. When the government bites off more than the people can tolerate, you tend to get a revival of those sentiments. And so I think starting back with the Patriot Act in 2001, a lot of people got upset. The overspending of the Bush administration, the financial crisis, the bailouts, the automobile takeovers, then followed by a national health care plan. All of those things pushed people in a Tea Party direction, and that was a libertarian surge. And then starting in 2008, you also had this other movement. President Obama campaigned as an opponent of marriage equality, an opponent of marijuana legalization. He's still an opponent of marijuana legalization. And yet, almost on election night 2008, movements in the direction of marriage equality and marijuana began happening. And to a lot of people, the Tea Party was a right-wing move, marijuana and marriage were a left-wing move. But to libertarians, it's all a manifestation of freedom and independence from government.
So libertarianism is latent in American society. I mean, that's really what you're saying the Founding Fathers were all about.
Oh, the Founding Fathers, but also American culture ever since. Abolitionism, the fact that we never had a real socialist party in the United States. All of those things reflect what I think is a deep-seated libertarianism. And a lot of libertarians are very depressed, and they don't buy this because they say, look, we got the New Deal and we got the Great Society and all of those things. Yes, but we never got as much of that as Europe did, and it reflects something in the American character that we never did. Plus, most of the sort of revolutions in American history have been revolutions that extend the promises of the Declaration of Independence to people to whom they had been denied. So the end of slavery and then eventually the end of Jim Crow, the inclusion of women into social and political and economic life. Later, beyond that, the inclusion of gay people into social and political life. All of those things really build on the promises of the Declaration of Independence.
You talked about how this kind of comes and goes in American society. And after Bush, the overreach that libertarians saw in foreign policy, Obama, the overreach that libertarians saw in domestic policy, this sort of crystallized into a great moment for libertarians. What about, I have to ask you about this, how much credit needs to go, David, to the political family of the Pauls, both Congressman Ron Paul and now Kentucky Senator Rand Paul? They've got high national profiles, and they've been talking about these ideas nationally for about a decade at least. I mean, longer than that, but prominently.
Well, Ron Paul had, nobody heard of Rand Paul until about 2009. He was just, you know, I come from a small town in Kentucky, and that's where he was. That's where he was also. But yes, I think in a sense there was a lot of tinder there, and Ron Paul's 2008 campaign lit a match to it. The big thing with Ron Paul's 2008 campaign was in 2007 when he suggested that 9/11 reflected a reaction to American meddling in the Middle East. And Rudy Giuliani, who has a penchant for creating controversy, reacted angrily and said, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. I've never heard such a theory. A few days later, Ron Paul held a press conference and said, here are six books I'm sending to Rudy Giuliani so he can understand the argument that actions have consequences. So yes, Ron Paul's campaign galvanized people on the internet. Rand Paul's campaign elected an unknown guy to the U.S. Senate who quickly became a focal point for libertarian ideas.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. David Bowes is here, Executive Vice President at the Cato Institute. He spoke at the Free State Project's Liberty Forum held this weekend. You can join us. Where do you line up with libertarian ideals, some of the ones that David mentioned a moment ago? And where might you part company with libertarians? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You know, I just threw out a couple issues there, David, of, you know, and you mentioned them too, marriage equality, marijuana legalization. Where do you think many Americans might line up with libertarians these days, no matter what political label they might attach to themselves?
Well, I think both of those issues, marriage and marijuana, are now slight majority positions. They were definitely minority positions 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. The general idea, government is too big and it spends too much, gets 60-65% agreement in America. Now, it's also true that when you say, should the government do more to help the poor, should the government do more for health care, you will also get a majority. So there's that tension. People, not everybody's an ideologue. Not everybody's read my book. but there is this tendency, and we have done polling, or actually we have looked at other people's polls, Gallup and Pew and so on, and they ask questions like, should the government promote traditional values or should the government not promote any set of values? Generally get a majority saying don't promote any set of values. Is the government taking on too many problems, or is it better to or should the government do more to solve social problems? You generally get a majority, don't take on more social problems. What we do is we combine those two numbers. How many people said keep the government out of both of those areas? And depending on how many of those questions you include, you get anywhere from 15-25% of Americans who take the libertarian position on two questions that you might consider one's a conservative and one's a liberal answer.
I did want to ask you also about the Tea Party since you mentioned it, and then dive into some of the issues that you mentioned in the book and that you just mentioned, David. But what about the Tea Party? Polls show that the Tea Party is now dropping in popularity. 15% of Americans say they're in support of the Tea Party movement. Another poll found that 30% of Americans say that they support a combination of libertarian positions. So where do you guys line up with the Tea Party? Are you the same or different or allies or what?
The Tea Party was not a libertarian movement or a libertarian organization. It was, I think, a libertarian force in American politics. I think the Tea Party originally erupted the week Congress was going to vote a $700 billion bailout for Wall Street. With no organization whatsoever, the phones on Capitol Hill started ringing and people saying, don't spend $700 billion to bail out Wall Street.
They went ahead and did it anyway, though.
They went ahead. Well, first they turned it down, which shocked all of Washington. If you had been in Washington then, reading the Washington Post, oh, my God, they turned down the thing that's going to save the country because the people are against it. Yes, a few days later, they rallied their troops in Congress. They, you know, Bernanke and Hank Paulson came down and told everybody it's an emergency. So, yes, they did it. But that created this anger. And then the automobile bailouts caused even more people to say, you have to be kidding. Now we're just bailing out individual industrial firms. Then you had President Obama gets elected. First thing he wants is another $800 billion spending program, and then his big thing is national health insurance. And all of those things brought forth a small government, anti-Washington, free enterprise, tax less, borrow less, spend less momentum. So the Tea Party didn't take positions on social issues or foreign policy, so it wasn't broadly libertarian, but it was a libertarian force. Now, I think what happened was that after the 2010 election, which was perceived as a Tea Party election that brought people like Rand Paul to Washington, Obama wasn't pushing any more big government schemes through Congress because now he had a Republican Congress to deal with, and therefore the momentum for the Tea Party sagged. And this is what I always warned people back in 2010. It is easy to get people angry right now. But can people stay motivated through the election and after the election? Because I can tell you the lobbyists and the spending interests never rest after the election. By Thursday, they're on the phone inviting the new members of Congress to dinner and to ski resorts.
It's so same old.
Yeah. So it's very hard for the people, and that depends, you know, that could be Bernie Sanders's people or it could be the Tea Party people. It's very hard for diffuse popular groups to retain that kind of commitment that paid lobbyists for interest groups retain.
You know, it's interesting you use the verb was when you talk about the Tea Party.
Yeah, I think the Tea Party has clearly faded as the focus of attention. And I do believe the Tea Party got very hostile reaction from the media, which included one time at one Tea Party rally, one person held a racist sign. And now everybody who follows the national media knows there were racist signs at Tea Parties. So I think those kinds of things, focus on anti-immigration, which to me was never the point of the Tea Party, distracted people from understanding what the Tea Party was really about. So I do think that as an organization, it's less significant than it was in 2010.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned immigration. After a short break, I definitely want to dive into some of these big issues that are being talked about right now, including immigration, wage inequality, environmental protection, economic growth, and so forth. We'll also take your calls at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is David Bowes. He's one of the country's leading libertarian thinkers, executive vice president at the Cato Institute, and the author of several books, including his most recent, The Libertarian Mind, A Manifesto for Freedom. He's been in New Hampshire as part of the Free State Project's annual convention held in Manchester over the weekend. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. What questions do you have about the libertarian philosophy? Do you find yourself lining up with libertarians on some issues, parting company with them on others? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And David Bowes, let's go right to our callers. Jonathan's joining us from Manchester. Hi, Jonathan. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a left-leaning liberal thinker, but I think many of the ideals that I hear espoused as libertarian and grew up with in New Hampshire as being libertarian are really being advanced by the left these days. The anti-surveillance movement and anti-NSA, the anti-interventionists movement, which you see Rand Paul backing away from and pledging at AIPAC and everything to his support for Israel. He's reversed on all of those things because he knows that the Tea Party and the right wing of the party cannot really advance those true libertarian ideas of anti-interventionism and still support have the money support of the Republican Party.
So, Jonathan, you call yourself more on the liberal end, but you find yourself lining up with libertarians in terms of foreign policy? Is that what you're saying?
I would say as far as foreign policy, as far as government intervention, as far as surveillance and spying and police work, transferring of military to local police stations and such as that. But
okay.
I would say that the real other thing that the Tea Party pushes and the libertarian movement on the right is pushing is anti-regulation. It doesn't protect workers. It doesn't protect towns or people against pollution and chemicals. They think that that's a libertarian ideal. This unfettered capitalism has been identified with libertarianism, and that would be great if humanity, and it could work through a marketplace, if humanity was a completely different creature.
Okay.
But what it really does is it undermines the poor, and so people who are empowered with money can come to the state of New Hampshire. They have money already.
And Jonathan, actually, I got a couple of emails that kind of line up with what you're saying, so let me share one of them also with David Bowes. Rob in Concord says, while libertarian arguments for individual freedom sound good, the anti-government bias sounds like rank selfishness and plays into the hands of the super rich and corporate interests. So that's an email from Rob, kind of lining up with the second part of your comment there, Jonathan. Thank you for calling. David Bowes, let's talk about the second part. He's right with you when it comes to, you know, government surveillance, intervention abroad, militarization of police. What's a libertarian approach toward environmental protection? Let's tackle that one first.
Well, I think that's a difficult issue for any political philosophy. It does involve the possibility of public goods. The market is by far the best way, indeed the only way, to allocate resources in society. Countries that tried not having markets, like the Soviet Union, ended up in disaster. So we now know that only the market can create, produce, and allocate resources. Air and water, difficult to allocate. So I think the principles are that we generally believe that property rights is a good basis for deciding you can't throw garbage in my front yard. Now, what does that tell us about what you can throw into my water or into my air? Air is particularly difficult to turn into property. Water is easier. You can't throw garbage into other people's water. Command and control regulation from Washington seems to me less efficient than relying on traditional common law rules about how to treat other people's property, including things like water. But these are difficult questions. And if we find that there are public goods aspects, externalities, then they may require some kind of regulation. What they don't require is the overwhelming regulation of the EPA and the centralization in Washington. So I think that's not the right way to go. And when you talk about benefiting the super rich, what benefits the super rich is a system in Washington that powerful people with powerful lobbyists can exploit. Libertarians want to restrict the power of the federal government so much that it won't do you any good to hire a lobbyist in Washington. If you read the Washington Post the Wall Street Journal these days, I noticed recently the business and tech section is all about the American dream, people inventing things, people bringing new products to market, products not finding a market and failing, businesses failing. All of that is capitalism. The front page and the editorial page are all about cronyism these days. There are businesses and foreign governments giving money to the Clinton Foundation while Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State and running for president? What's that all about? There are governments all over the country buying new stadiums for billionaire team owners. There are green energy subsidies going to billionaires like Tom Steyer. There are subsidies for old-fashioned industries like the steel industry, protecting people from competition from overseas. All of these things are things libertarians want to restrict government from being able to do. And then the super rich would have to actually make money by selling you stuff in the marketplace.
I definitely want to ask you about wage inequality, the super rich, given our caller and given our email. But one more question about environmental protection. One of the big selling points at the Free State Projects Convention this weekend was come to New Hampshire. It has a beautiful natural environment. Part of that natural environment was created by government regulation, protection of natural resources, saying that you can't dump X, Y, or Z, saying that you can't build on the White Mountain National Forest. So I'm interested in a little more detail, David, on just how you keep that environment clean, healthy, beautiful for all of us without some form of rules, regulations saying, no, you can't do that. You can't build here. You can't dump here.
You may need some kind of rules and regulations. You want to be careful not to have an excessive number. The environmental abuses in socialist countries were far worse than those in capitalist countries. And one of the reasons is that in capitalist countries, people get richer. And as we get richer, we demand more environmental amenities. And we get that partly through private activities like the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy, and so on. We get it partly, whether libertarians like it or not, through government regulation. And so all of that has played a role. But the fact is, the main thing that has helped our environment is the fact that we get wealthier, we demand more environmental amenities, and we waste less. As a society gets wealthier and more efficient, it wastes less, and that's good for the environment.
Who brings those environmental amenities, though? I mean, you mentioned Sierra Club. Here in New Hampshire, for example, the rivers used to be pretty – some of them used to be pretty ugly because people used to dump chemicals and so forth. Then the Clean Water Act came, and a lot of people credit the Clean Water Act with making New Hampshire a more beautiful place.
A lot of people do. If you look at a graph of how much pollution there has been, you can't find the point on the graph where the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act were passed. Things were getting better, and they kept on getting better. I do think when you talk about rivers, as I was saying, you can't throw garbage in other people's yards. You can't throw garbage in other people's waters. So traditionally, the rule was if you had an existing claim, a homestead of part of the flow of a river, then other people couldn't cut off your flow. They also couldn't put garbage in it. So I think traditional common law mechanisms would have worked there. And one of the problems was in the 19th century, we were so hell-bent on economic development that courts started saying traditional common law property rights protections need to be overridden in the interest of society's interest in economic development. Well, libertarians would have said, no, don't override common law and property rights in the interests of some social good. And we say that again today. Stick to common law and property rights. Don't override it in the interest of today's dominant ideology. But if we had stuck with it in the first place, we would have had less water pollution all along.
Would you be happier if the states controlled environmental protections?
Yes. In general, I think federalism and decentralization are good libertarian principles. The Catholics call it subsidiarity. Do things at the lowest level possible. So, yes, I think in general it's better to have these things done at the state and local level.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Join us. We're talking with David Bowes of the Cato Institute. He's been in town for the Free State Project annual convention. We're talking about libertarian ideals, how it's a good moment for libertarians in American politics today, and how libertarians would deal with some of the big issues before us as a society, including, as we've been talking about, the environment. We'll also look at illegal immigration, the wage gap. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. And David in Sanbornton, Fletcher's on the phone. Hi, Fletcher. Go ahead.
Hi there. What is the libertarian view, the philosophy of is there a role for government in confronting big corporations when they get so powerful that they're able to influence the free market themselves? I'm thinking of, you know, the classic example. I just read a book about Teddy Roosevelt and Standard Oil. At that time, they felt that the government had to do something about Standard Oil, you know, gobbling up the market. What is the libertarian view of the role, if any, for government in that situation?
Interesting. So kind of a counter to big corporations that control our food supply, where our energy comes from, how we access information. I mean, the idea that in this era of very large businesses controlling so much, do you need sort of a counter, government to play a counter to that big corporate power? Thank you for the question, Fletcher.
You keep using this word control. I don't think it means what you think it means. what Standard Oil was doing back in the late 19th century was dramatically reducing the price of oil to consumers. That seems to me a good thing. That's what corporate efficiency is supposed to do. And yes, one of the ways they became more efficient was buy up less efficient companies and make them more efficient. They never had a monopoly. The way you get monopolies is to have the government protect them. What's a monopoly today? The post office is a monopoly. What's a monopoly? The schools are pretty close to a monopoly because if you want to go outside, you have to pay double. What is not a monopoly? Remember when Microsoft was a monopoly 20 years ago? Do you remember seriously people thought MySpace was a natural monopoly that needed to be broken up by the government? Now they think Facebook is. Maybe there will be something else coming up. In all of these cases, businesses are competing to provide us with things they want, or things we want. And Walmart, how did Walmart get big? Because it sold basic stuff to low-income people cheaper than anybody else. I think that's a good way to get big. Government, when it gets big, can force me to do things. When I was 19 years old, I was worried about being drafted and sent to Vietnam. No corporation has ever threatened to draft me. They have threatened to sell me things cheaper than their competitors do, and I'm not worried about being offered things cheaper than other companies.
That was the moment when libertarianism got started, right, David? People were upset about the Vietnam War. I mean, you said it's always been latent in American political society.
It got started pretty well in the American Revolution.
Yeah, exactly. But that moment, talk about that a little bit more.
That was an important moment. If you think about the modern libertarian movement, Brian Doherty wrote a book about the modern libertarian movement. We date it in a way from 1943, when three remarkable women published books the same year. Rose Wilder Lane, the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder, published a book called The Discovery of Freedom. Isabel Patterson, a New York writer, published a book called The God of the Machine. And the most famous of these women, the youngest of them, was Ayn Rand, who published The Fountainhead that year. So 1943, think about it. It is the darkest year in human history. The Nazis control most of Europe. The Soviet Communist Party is extending its control. In the United States, from a libertarian point of view, we have a war economy and the New Deal. Not a good time. And these three women wrote these fabulous books, and people read them. And it was a tiny movement then, but it grew. The next year, F.A. Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom, and then Milton Friedman came along. But yes, around 1970, in what I would call the era of Vietnam, Watergate, and stagflation, what did we see? We saw war, corruption, and the government can't run the economy well. And that moved a lot of people in a libertarian direction. And some of the institutions of the libertarian movement, like the Libertarian Party, started then.
Why do you think the party has had such a hard time, David, gaining national office? I mean, we've got Rand Paul and Ron Paul.
He's a Republican.
But beyond that, yes.
That's right. The Libertarian Party is like any other third party in America. Americans just don't believe in third parties. We have a political system. We have a political system that encourages two major parties. We have a lot of barriers to entry. You know, to get a presidential candidate on the ballot, you have to do it in all 50 states, and it takes probably 1 million valid signatures, which means you got to get 2 million signatures. So you have to spend $1 million or $2 million just to get on the ballot before you can start campaigning, and you're not getting any PAC donations. You're not getting any big money if you're a third party. So it's just very challenging. I used to, in my misguided youth, I petitioned for the Libertarian Party, and I would go out on the streets and say, you know, would you sign this petition to get this new party on the ballot? And people say, we've got enough parties already. I always wanted to take that as a libertarian attitude. I don't like either of the big parties. Why would I want another one?
Well, that's the interesting thing. And when you talk about libertarians, you know, trying to affect political change or governmental change, in a way, some libertarians would say, I don't want anything to do with any of this. So,
well, that's absolutely right. One of the reasons libertarians don't do as well as they do in politics is libertarians don't like politics. They don't want to be involved in it. And in some sense, libertarianism is about making it possible for people not to be involved in politics. I just think some libertarians are jumping the gun.
Let's take another email. This is from another Rob. He said, what would libertarians do, underlined, about some of our biggest problems? And he's got a couple here. We can't deal with all of them right now, but he mentions Social Security, the tax code, illegal immigration, the swelling welfare rolls. just for the next couple of minutes, let's talk about immigration, because this has been a big fight in Washington. What's the libertarian approach to immigration and the 12 million or so people believed to be here illegally?
Well, I think the general libertarian approach is that immigration has been good for America. This is a nation of immigrants. My family was here before 1776, so I guess we could have shut the borders to everybody else. But I think the various people who came in the 19th century, the 20th century, have made this a stronger, richer, more interesting country, and that is still the case. People like to say illegal immigration. Well, in the 19th century, it was all legal or illegal. There were no rules. You could just come in.
Yeah, anyone
if you got here,
come.
You could come in. So I always wonder when I hear the Pat Buchanans and people say, my ancestors came here legally, because nobody was trying to stop them. So it would be good if things were done legally. Things would be done more legally if we had larger quotas for letting people in, if we didn't have such restrictive rules about people getting in. We know we're not going to deport 12 million illegal immigrants. Everybody knows that. The Republicans know it. The Democrats know it. And I believe that the polls show that most Americans want a path to citizenship. So most Republicans want to find a solution to this. Most Democrats want to find it. The problem is finding one path, one solution that both Democrats and Republicans in Congress will agree to. But in general, immigrants improve our economy. They improve our society. We ought to be more open to immigration. If that means having more temporary worker visas or just larger quotas in general, we should be trying to find a way for more people to come here legally. And sure, we should secure our borders, but realistically, we have thousands of miles of borders, and we're not going to completely secure them, so we might as well accept that. One of the things people worry about is that immigrants will take our jobs. That is a completely wrong-headed understanding of economics. It's zero-sum economics. In my view, it's found more on the left than on the right. People who come here and take jobs also become consumers. They buy things from us. Also, they produce things. In Washington, D.C., my house was mostly built by immigrants. My sandwiches are mostly made by immigrants. I think that's a good thing. Now, the welfare state for immigration is a bigger challenge, and I understand why people are concerned about that.
So, Rob, we'll pick up on your point after a short break. And a couple other emails here, too, that I want to share with you, David Bowes. You can give us a call, too, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, understanding Islamic parties, political violence, and extremism with scholar and U.S. diplomat Haroon Ullah. Today, libertarian scholar David Bowes is with us, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. We're discussing some of the themes in his book, The Libertarian Mind, revised and updated edition of Libertarianism, a Primer. David Bowes is in New Hampshire this week as part of the Free State Project's convention held in Manchester over the weekend. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking a look at where libertarians come down and some of the big issues facing our nation, including environmental protection, immigration. Let's talk, David Bowes, about the other question posed by Rob. I think he said expanding welfare roles. Somebody else who emailed wanted to talk about wage inequality. Where does a libertarian mindset come down on that? There's a lot of talk now about wage inequality, both on the Republican and the Democratic sides.
Well, I think generally libertarians believe in free markets and smaller government. So when you talk about the tax code, I want taxes to be lower, flatter, and simpler. When you talk about welfare rolls, I think it's a problem that the welfare rolls have increased so much in the Obama administration. That's obviously partly a result of the bad economy, but it's more than that. The Obama administration has been out there campaigning to get more people on the welfare rolls. The national debt, now $18 trillion. How are we ever going to pay that off? That's why libertarians want to move toward things like private accounts for Social Security that would take people off the taxpayer dole and allow them to save and invest for their own future. When you talk about wage inequality, the first question that I want to know is, do you actually care about inequality, or do you care about poverty and stagnant middle-class wages? Because if that's the issue, then let's have solutions for poverty, which in my view is having an economy that's growing with less regulation and lower taxes and less of a burden of debt on the economy. If you're worried about stagnant middle-class wages, then we should talk about the fact that since everybody's got an iPad and an iPhone now, it's not entirely clear that our wages have been stagnant, but they're not growing as fast as they should. And again, I think that's the burden of excess government that has accumulated, and we have too many regulations blocking people from occupations, too many regulations protecting the people who are already in those jobs. If you're actually concerned about inequality, the fact that on any given day I get $100 richer and Bill Gates gets $100,000 richer, well, I just have to say that doesn't bother me. As long as my income and standard of living are getting better, it doesn't bother me whether Bill Gates has $1 billion or $50 billion.
Sure,
he's,
and I'm not
he's
about
way
you or
richer
me,
than I am.
Yeah, I'm talking about people who sort of just feel like they can't get ahead. And,
but then
you know.
In that case, the problem is that they can't get ahead, and they are not being held down by the wealth of Bill Gates. They are being held down by the regulations that protect people who already have jobs, people who already have big companies. There are regulations that protect the biggest companies in America from foreign competition, the taxi cartels from the competition of Uber. I mentioned earlier the stadiums. Why are we building stadiums for billionaires? Why not leave that money in the pockets of people who might spend it to hire more people at local levels?
We looked at wage inequality last week on The Exchange, and one of the things that kept coming up was that Americans spend so much on higher education and healthcare, two areas where if they had a better footing, they might not have to spend so much in that area. They could spend more on, you know, goods that make them happy, better houses, better jobs. And so
well,
on.
And
what
both
do you think about that?
Both of those are classic examples of how government subsidies drive up the price. 50 to 70% of healthcare expenses are now paid for by the government. As Senator Phil Graham said some years ago, if we paid for food the way we pay for healthcare, I would eat better and so would my dog. Because if you had prepaid food insurance so that every time you went to the grocery, you didn't pay anything, you'd buy steak every night and you'd give your dog steak. The point is, in the marketplace, when I think about buying a car or a computer or a shirt, I think about how much it costs. I never buy a shirt at full price. But you can't do that. You can't shop that way in the healthcare market, and you don't bother doing it because either your employer is paying for it or the government is paying for it. So we need to get back to having consumers with skin in the game when they buy healthcare. And that's also true in higher education. So much of it is subsidized with government loans and grants that consumer pressure isn't there to the same extent.
Because you don't feel the sticker shock as much.
Right. The things where prices are rising the most are the ones where government is most heavily involved.
So, and we've done hours and hours and hours and hours on the Affordable Care Act and so forth. So I'm not going to ask you a lot more on that. But one more question. So given what you just said, how do you feel about these health insurance marketplaces where people go online and buy health insurance and people who are low income get a little subsidy to help pay for it? That should make you happy, right?
We have marketplaces all over the world. I don't need the government car exchange. I just go look at the newspaper ads for automobiles and I ask my friends. I have a friend. I don't know anything about cars, but I have a colleague at Cato who knows a lot about them. He gives me advice when I want to buy a car and then I check the prices. That's what you can't do in healthcare because it's so heavily regulated and subsidized. I thought one of my prescriptions was getting really expensive, so I tried to go to two other drugstores and say, how much will it be? They can't tell me because until I put the prescription in, they don't know what the various interactions of my employer, my insurance, their company, which ones they – so they – you can't price shop. So, yes, we ought to be able to get back to price shopping, and I don't think that's what government-run exchanges were designed to do.
Again, our number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Lynn. She says, yes to doing things at the state and local level. Lynn says, feds have too much power. Checks and balances seem to be gone. Thanks for that one, Lynn. Here's one from Sarah. She says, I'm enjoying Mr. Bose's perspective. Have found myself more sympathetic to libertarianism since moving to New Hampshire. Sarah does go on to say, perhaps I misheard his comments on government regulation of monopolies, but I think it's misleading to say the worst a monopoly can do is provide people with goods for less money. Big business is one thing, Sarah says. Monopoly is another. And monopoly means that a particular company has so cornered the market that they can charge whatever they want for their product. And if you want or need that product, you must pay. Thank you, Sarah, for that email. Just real quick, what do you think, David Bose? A little concerned about monopoly there, although she says she likes a lot of what you have to say.
I don't know what company that is. Facebook and Google are not overcharging me. They're free. U.S. Steel now has to compete with international steel companies. Automobile prices have been falling, at least in quality-related terms. Computer prices have been falling. The things where the price is rising because we don't have a choice, the post office, healthcare, higher education, all heavily government-regulated and subsidized.
Sarah, thanks for the email. Here's another one from someone who didn't give a name. He says, he or she says, it is not true that as societies get richer, they get more efficient. An American household uses many times more energy and resources than a third world household. Not saying better or worse, just far less efficient. The richer you are, the easier it is to waste because it's comparatively cheaper. Thanks to that person. Do you want to comment on that real quickly, David?
Yes. For me as an individual, because I'm not living at subsistence, it's easier for me to waste. For corporations, however, if you talk to somebody from the Coca-Cola company, they will tell you that every dollar they can make in profit matters to them, and therefore they don't throw anything away. When they package orange juice, they squeeze the oil out of the orange for one purpose. They feed the orange peels to the pigs. When they stamp the old-fashioned Coke bottle tops out of a piece of metal, they said, what can we do with the piece of metal that has all the holes in it? They figured out it could become furnace filters, and so they found a way to turn it into furnace filters. A big corporation wants nothing to go to waste because every waste is a lost profit. So, yes, I do believe that although we spend more because we have more, we're getting things for that. A more developed capitalist economy is using resources more efficiently to satisfy more human needs.
Thanks for that email. Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Mark's calling from Sanborn. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Good morning. I just wanted to inject an app that is developed in Portsmouth, New Hampshire by a company down there, and it's called MyMedicalShopper.com. And as a person that has a high copay or deductible, this thing, to give you an example, I have routine blood work done, and I've had it done at a particular hospital, and it usually costs about $490. What doesn't get paid by the insurance company obviously gets laid off on my copay.
Right.
Using this app, I looked up the same procedure for medical tests or blood testing and was able to get it just up the street for $90. The same
wow, that's a big savings, isn't it?
Well, the thing they were talking about on this app is in New Hampshire, because they have all the rates and the reimbursements from all the insurance carriers in New Hampshire that they've aggregated into this app for the procedures that are done. But if we'd used it last year alone in New Hampshire, we would have saved over $326 million.
Wow. And yeah, Mark, thank you for calling in. You know, quick thoughts on this app that he talks about, and then I have a broader question for
Well,
you.
I think it's good to get things like that. I think as long as we have such a heavily government-dominated medical system, it's going to be harder to shop by price, and fewer people are going to care. He has a high copay, so he cares. An awful lot of people do not have high copays.
Although they're getting higher all the time.
Well, that's right, because the expenses are getting higher, and the expenses are getting higher because people didn't have high copays. They just said somebody else is paying for it. The more we actually are paying for what we're getting, the more we will want apps like that, and more people will use them, and people will run ads. For LASIK surgery, which is typically not covered by insurance, you see newspaper ads with prices in it. What you don't see is a newspaper ad for the price for a heart operation, because that, you know, the insurance company is going to pay for.
You know, I wonder, libertarians have long said, you know, consumers making informed choices, and then the knock against that was, well, consumers don't have perfect information. But given technology, given that there is so much information that you can easily access, like our caller, through an app, I wonder how you feel about the role of just easy access to all kinds of information in terms of supporting the principles that you stand for, David.
Markets always worked better than control and centralization and socialism, but the internet is making it easier for us to access information, and so that's absolutely true. It was always the case that the best pizza places tended to get good word of mouth, but now I can come to Manchester and I can just go on the internet and say, best pizza Manchester, and see what people say. And on larger things too, best computer, best automobile, it's making it easier for buyers and sellers to find each other.
Thank you for that call. And here's an email that just came in from Richard in Chester. It's real interesting. He says, while Mr. Bose's libertarian beliefs often resonate with people on both sides of the political spectrum, including, he says, a liberal like myself, he says it's the details of governing a complex society on which libertarianism is unclear to me. So Richard says, I'd like Mr. Bose to answer his libertarian views on the following questions with simple yes or no answers. So let's give this a try, because there's some interesting things here. Mandated speed limits.
The world is too complex for yes or no answers. But I will say that as long as the government owns the roads, the government has the right to set the rules on the roads.
Legalizing heroin.
For adults, adults should be able to make the important decisions about their own lives, and we would have less crime and less corruption in police departments if we ended drug prohibition.
That's a long-held libertarian belief for all kinds of drugs, right,
yes,
David?
That's
not
right.
Just marijuana.
Adults should be able to decide what they put in their bodies.
So under 18, you say no.
That's right. Children are in a different situation in any political philosophy, but adults should be able to decide.
Zoning. That's his next question.
Zoning is an interesting question.
Private property issue.
It is a private property issue. We do live together. We live near each other. Houston is notorious for never having had zoning. And if you go to Houston, it doesn't seem very different from Dallas. But everything is when I drove around Houston some years ago, the guy who was driving me around kept saying, it'll be 15 minutes to the next stop. Is everything 15 minutes? Yeah, pretty much. And it's partly because of the lack of zoning. It meant that things were near where people wanted them. So in general, I'm opposed to zoning. I'm in favor of people being able to do what they want to with their own property and to make covenants and contracts that might limit what you can do. For instance, if you create a subdivision, you're likely going to put some restrictions in that on what you can do. You can't bring a pig farm into it.
A subdivision. So that's almost like a homeowners
association.
Right.
I live in a homeowners association. There are rules on what I can and can't do, but I voluntarily agreed to those.
All right. So if you wanted to be a pig farmer, you wouldn't move there.
Right.
All right. Here's another one from Richard in Chester. This is a couple more on his list. Legalize prostitution.
Adults should be able to decide what they want to do with their own bodies.
Income taxes.
Taxes should be lower, flatter, and simpler. I do believe that income taxes are more intrusive. They require us to report what we earned and how we spent it. Therefore, I prefer property taxes and sales taxes.
Private ownership of weapons of mass destruction.
I think weapons of mass destruction, like nuclear weapons or chemical and biological warfare, are a clear and present danger. It is dangerous enough for governments to have them.
Thank you for that that list, Richard. It's interesting. You know, talking about roads and weapons of mass destruction and so forth, where do libertarians feel that government really does have a clear role? You mentioned roads, for example.
Well, I think that libertarians believe government exists to protect our life, liberty, and property. So we need national defense. We don't need to conduct wars all over the world, but we need national defense. We need police to arrest people who violate our rights. We need courts to prosecute those people and to settle the disputes that arise between us. But beyond that, not very much. Education would clearly be better off in a free market. I don't even say schools, because who knows, in 2015, do we really need schools? We need education. But are schools the best way to provide education? I don't know, and we won't know until we have a competitive market. Roads. Roads are a useful service.
Snow plowing.
Well, let's start with roads. Roads are a useful service. Useful services will be provided on the free market, so why do we need the government to do it?
I don't know.
You live in Concord. You occasionally want to get to Manchester.
Yes.
Right? You would even pay for that privilege. In fact, you do pay for it. You have toll roads up here. Well, but you have toll roads up here, too. So why do you need the government to supply useful goods and services? We don't have the government build the automobiles. Why does it need to build the roads?
I wonder if there's an argument that nobody but government would build roads to some of the most remote areas where it would be difficult. Sounds like we saw Verizon get out of New Hampshire's landline business because it was just too difficult.
I'm sure Walmart or Google would build roads anywhere there was a profit to be made. Now, if the town is so small that there is that they're not willing to pay for the road there, then maybe that's not an efficient place to live.
I have one last very quick question for you, David Bose. As I said, you were in New Hampshire this weekend speaking at the Free State Project Convention, which is all about getting liberty-minded folks to move to New Hampshire. You know where I'm going with this question. Are you considering moving to New Hampshire to be part of this grand experiment?
Well, I'll tell you, the idea of a state with no income tax sounds libertarian enough to me, but it's too cold up here.
That's not a good excuse. But spoken like a guy from Kentucky.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That's David Bose. Again, he's Executive Vice President at the Cato Institute in New Hampshire this weekend for the Free State Project's Liberty Forum. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Dylan Morrill. The theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.